Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest in our series of spoiler special podcasts. This one is dedicated to the latest comic book movie to blaze a trail at the box office, David Ayer's Suicide Squad, the third movie in the DCEU, or DC Extended Universe, in layman's terms. Or movies based in DC Comics, in layman's terms. Join me over the next hour or so to discuss the movie and tackle your questions about it, our Empire's very own Captain Boomerang, a man who comes back no matter how hard we try to throw him away. I'm joking, of course. It's our Suicide Squad spoiler special set specialist, all the S's, Nick Dissemblian.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, Nick. How are you?
I own a boomerang, actually, from a visit to Australia when long ago. Interesting fact.
That is an interesting fact.
Do you own a cuddly toy unicorn?
That's very personal information.
You were on set of Suicide Squad for how many days?
It was about 3.5 days in the end.
So that's more than Adam Beach.
It may have been longer than Adam Beach. I got a feeling he was on set for a while. I actually had a 45-minute conversation with Adam Beach, a.k.a. Slipknot, which is a lot longer than his presence in the film. And I really thought he was going to be in the film a lot more than he was. I think he did too.
Yeah, perhaps. There's Nick. Next up, we have our very own Amanda Waller, a tough-talking, hard-thinking, shrewd operator who always eats in the most expensive restaurants in town and gets someone else to pay for it. It's Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
How are you?
I don't feel like that's a compliment, but I'll take it anyway.
It is a compliment.
It is a compliment. Okay,
it's more of a compliment. Yeah.
Fair enough, yeah.
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 Okay, it's a compliment.
Thank you. I'm well, thank you. I am looking forward to learning more about this from Nick and talking about this film.
And then, of course, it's me. Who am I in the Suicide Squad parlance? Probably Slipknot. Who am I? My Rick Flag? The guy trying to get you guys to cooperate and do what I want you to do,
no,
but I can't, and my hair keeps changing length.
You're Scott Eastwood, sorry. You're the guy who people kind of forget was there, but when they're reminded of you, they go, that guy was in it.
Hang on. Isn't Scott Eastwood, his name, I believe, is GQ.
GQ.
Presumably because he's, like, super handsome.
Yes.
So, because of the Gentleman's Quarterly magazine?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, GQ. Before you hear us three Egypts talk about the movie, let's hear from the film's writer and director, David Ayer, for it is he. He spoke to Nick and James Dyer, for Lay Our Lay, when he came to London recently, and fairly no-holds-barred chat about the film.
Yeah, moderately.
Moderately no-holds-barred. Some holds were barred.
I did wish that I'd pressed him a bit more on the deleted scenes, especially the Joker stuff, which a lot of people are talking about. But he, as you could probably tell, he was a little bit down and clearly smarting from the reviews. And he kept kind of bringing the conversation back to the reviews and stuff. So I don't think he was in quite the mood to really get in.
This was the day after the premiere, when the reviews had just been unleashed.
Yeah, and sometimes I think the directors are not keen to talk about the alternate cuts, the stuff that didn't get in just after the film has come out, because they want people to watch the film that's there, not think about stuff that was cut. But yeah, he was good. He was on good form. He's a very candid guy.
All right. Well, enjoy this interview with David Ayer. Of course, as ever, this is a spoiler special, so if you have not seen Suicide Squad, stop listening, watch the film, come back, and then listen to us, unless, of course, you're a weird spoiler junkie, in which case, you know, have at it. But here you are, David Ayer talking to Nick and James.
We're delighted to welcome director David Ayer to the Empire podcast for a Suicide Squad spoiler special. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
We're going to dive straight into the big stuff. We want to talk about Boomerang's pink plushie, Pinky, which is a pink pony. Where the hell did that come from?
It came about, it was actually intended to be a piece of set decoration in one of our office building sets. And as he was unpacking his bag, I thought he needed just a little something kind of fun and silly, and asked that get grabbed off the truck. And it sort of kept appearing throughout the film at that point, became a bit of his mascot.
Yeah. Well, Boomerang doesn't get a sort of a fantasy sequence near the end of the film like some of the other characters do. Would Pinky have appeared in his fantasy?
Absolutely. I think there would have been a full-size live Pinky. But, you know, in his fantasy sequence, I imagined him on a throne surrounded by, you know, acolytes, some sort of, you know, primitive god.
And beer, a lot of beer.
Much beer, kegs and casks.
So is the idea that he's a, I believe the term is a brony.
Yes, Brony. Which is fine. I mean, look, I think it's a good thing, and it gives him a little hobby besides robbing banks.
where did Pinky end up?
I believe the hero Pinky is locked in a case in a warehouse in Burbank.
Like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Exactly. No, there is this giant, the Warner Archives, they call it, and there is this vast warehouse with God knows what mysteries and treasures locked away.
Did you keep any of the sort of props or weapons or any of that stuff yourself?
I don't know if I could. Let me consult my attorney before I comment on that one.
All right. And I guess just to start with the beginning of the movie, was the plan always to open with Deadshot in Belrev, or were there multiple kind of versions as you tried to figure that out?
Well, the very first script started in Belrev and told the story, you know, the backstories of everybody in these sort of flashback montages. And, you know, the original conception is that they would almost be these memory bursts, you know, as they sort of sat in their cells recalling their previous lives, and also to get the audience up to speed about who they are and how they ended up there. So, you know, the first impulse was always to do a montage in the first act structure, but you chase different things. I mean, there's a linear version we did where it opens up with June in the cave and her sort of explorations there, and tells the story in sequence, you know, with the arrests and Batman, and then we go to Belrev. So we tried a lot of different versions. You know, honestly, there may be six or seven different versions of the film, which is kind of a normal thing to do as you try and find what flows the best and how to get the information to the audience as kind of quickly as possible.
Because there's an incredible amount of character exposition that you need to get through. Because who are these guys? You know, what do they mean to the film?
It's brutal. I mean, it's brutal the amount of information you have to give, you know, to an audience. And, you know, it is the squad, and it is about this group coming together. And we need to know who they are, what their histories are. And we're finding out that sort of in the more linear version that, you know, the audience was left with a lot of questions and was a little disoriented as to who to watch and why. So we came up with this sort of what we call the dossier version, which has Amanda Waller presenting the, you know, the backstories and origins of the various members.
Mm-hmm. Did Slipknot ever get his own? Yeah, did you shoot a?
Yeah, we shot one. But after a point, it became overloaded, you know, so you have to cull and pick and choose your battles, and Slipknot gets his head blown off pretty quick. So, you know, I made a commitment early on not to try and create some kind of misdirect, because when you have that many characters, every frame of real estate is priceless, and I didn't want to invest you know, in that real estate to create some misdirect, because after opening night, everyone knows he dies anyway. So,
did it involve strangling his backstory flashback? Because I talked to Adam and he talked a lot about the strangling practice he'd done.
That might be more about his sort of personal journey as to getting into the character more than anything. But I mean, I guess it does make sense. If it's a rope guy, I could see where he could make those connections.
And there's a blink and you'll miss it on Harley Quinn's bio when it says implicit in the death of Robin.
Yes.
Is there a canonical story of how that happened? I mean, because it's referenced obviously in Batman vs. Superman as well.
Right, exactly. The idea that, you know, the Joker killed Robin, and, you know, the idea thereby being, you know, this is sort of my personal thing, and maybe less about, you know, a larger connection, and it could, you know, be revised downstream. But, you know, Joker killed Robin, and Batman basically smashes his teeth out and locks him up in Arkham Asylum. And, you know, it's in the asylum where Joker would have done the damage tattoo as a message to Batman, saying, "You've damaged me. You know, I was so beautiful before, and now you've, you know, destroyed my face." But that's where the grill comes from.
Yeah, there's so much detail that's kind of there and you could dig into. I loved some of the stats that you had when you introduced like Deadshot. He had a big list of guns, which is there for like a second, but I spotted it's potato gun and musket.
Yes. It's fun to add a little bit of silliness, like, Colonel Flagg has a three golf handicap.
Is that Joel's actual handicap?
I don't know. Will's really the golfer, but it was a fun way to kind of blast through this information.
Could Deadshot kill somebody with a potato gun?
Absolutely. I mean, it depends on the potato, I
think. As you're part of an extended universe, there's a larger narrative arc. How much of that was prescribed to you, and how much of that were you able to draw yourself?
Well, we always knew we'd end up back in Bell Rev. But again, it's my best analogy is this is a fleet of ships crossing the ocean, but you get to be the captain of your own vessel. Initially, there's a lot of discussion about how to connect to the Justice League movie. Obviously, in continuity, this is post Batman versus Superman, and there's several inbound projects, obviously, with Wonder Woman, which is actually an earlier timeline than this, so that was kind of free and clear of any friendly fire. But the Flash movie, Cyborg movie, all these other Aquaman movies, etc., are sort of in a similar present day timeline, so we just had to steer clear of all that.
Well, the Flash is in the movie, obviously.
Yes.
In the Boomerang setup.
Yeah, because Boomerang is a Flash character, a Flash villain traditionally, and so it only made sense that it would be the Flash that captured him. So we dropped Ezra in for his brief cameo.
Well, that's nice. So the idea is they've met before, or is this the
exactly
their old rivals?
Exactly. That there's that there's a history of rivalry between them.
Yeah, and obviously you get Batman in there a few times, and was that always there in your script, or was that something that...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I signed on board, I explicitly asked for Batman. I wanted to show Batman as an opposition. Everything's always done in his viewpoint. In this case, we see Batman through the eyes of the baddies that he arrests in this case. So I thought it was important to show how he takes them down.
Can I ask, are you by any chance a big John Carpenter fan?
I actually am, yeah.
Yeah, I really felt that kind of the Escape from New York was a real touchstone for this film.
Yeah, no, it's very, very Escape from New York, very, very mission-based. It's an interesting film. It's kind of fascinating how, the film's getting eviscerated by so many of the critics, and it's fascinating because in a lot of ways, I mean, this is kind of an art movie, and I know just saying that is going to provoke incredible howls of outrage out there, but it's really this anarchic punk rock art movie. The Enchantress, the plot, all these things are taking these hits, but the film is really... It's the journey of the soul. I mean, you have, this woman, June Moon, in a lot of ways you could say that this film sort of evolves or manifests out of her soul, out of her heart. And a lot of the movie is the war for her heart, literally. And she goes into this cave where, she's presented with, this animal-headed god presenting her with, these male and female idols, where she becomes, possessed by this alter ego. And it's this alter ego that's, hypersexual and primitive and destructive and angry and rageful and vengeful, and just seeks really to destroy as this, sort of force of soul, force of nature component. And everybody else who now has to take her down also experiences their own sort of dark night of the soul as they go along the journey through this abandoned city to confront her. And then the idea that she offers up this fantasy reality to people where she can provide them with a false nirvana, a false happiness. And so the film in a lot of ways is really about the splitting of the personality and addiction and the dark side of the soul. And I probably would have fared much better in the critical trades had I just had a standard issue bad guy in a suit and tie, very corporate, building robots to take over the world.
Yeah. You did something which very few films do these days, and you managed to keep pretty much the whole third act and all the supernatural stuff pretty much secret right until the film came out.
Yes.
Do you think that that people were kind of surprised by that and not ready for it?
Absolutely. I think it's a combination of factors. One of them being that I think there was an expectation of what the film should have been, and the Joker, people really wanted more Joker and wanted him to be an A-plot component. And it's funny how, you know, the critics call it a cameo, but he has some, you know, fantastic sequences in the film. They're really important for the film. Great action sequences, and really influences the journey quite a bit. And it's that Harley Joker relationship, you know, defines so much of who she is. Everything about this film is incredibly controversial, and you know, in a lot of ways it's really a miracle that I got to make it. And it is kind of shocking that, you know, in the analysis, critique, you know, media side, no one has really reverse engineered what I'm really saying.
I mean, just going to the Joker, as you bring him up, there's that really memorable scene early on where he's in a kind of circle of blades.
Yes.
Mm. And are there baby clothes also in that
yes.
circle? I was
yes.
wondering about that.
Yeah, there's some onesies there.
What's the story with that?
Some roses, some onesies, some piano keys, cell phones, laptops, obviously a lot of knives and weapons, a lot of empty bottles, and some tied off bags of God knows what.
That's a really interesting image. I just was curious about what it means. Quite sort of intriguing.
It was inspired a little bit from Pink Floyd, the movie, okay. when Pink goes insane in the hotel room. But it's, you know, I think whether it's love or obsession or, you know, how do you define a feeling in a heart? How do you define love? How do you define obsession? It's a subjective feeling. And there's a lot of relationships and marriages that are of the nature of Joker and Harley's. He's obsessed with her, and I think he hates that he needs her.
There were so many rumors during the making of the film, and I remember reading three separate stories about Scott Eastwood, that he was playing Green Arrow, Dick Grayson, and Deathstroke at different
yes,
times.
Yes.
None of which turned out to be true.
No. No, he's one of the, you know, he's Flagg's right-hand man.
GQ.
You know, GQ plays a fairly straightforward military character.
Yeah, I was just wondering generally about the stories, you know, because there's been so much chatter online about the film as you were making it. Was there anything that stuck out that made you kind of laugh or go, where the hell did that come from?
Really the Joker being Jason Todd was interesting, but you know, with the Robin costume in the Batcave and BVS, you know, obviously that just triggered a lot of speculation as people tried to find framing to put around it.
Yeah. There was one story I saw about the Riddler being a villain in the film. I take it that is complete nonsense.
Didn't happen. I have seen the movie, and I don't recall seeing the Riddler.
So this is your first experience of making a film that gets this kind of crazy, crazy scrutiny.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's both a wonderful and a terrible thing. It's people seem to project so much into these movies. They push so much into them. And it's creates an incredible amount of expectation.
Yeah, I spotted the Ostrander building.
Federal yes.
building is sort of featured in the movie, which is a really nice Easter egg. Obviously, John Ostrander.
Yes.
Is the guy who created Suicide Squad in the
who did the really the 1980s run, the classic Suicide Squad run, is the author of that, and also. In many ways, the source of some of the storylines in here. I mean, you know, the Suicide Squad is an incredibly dark comic, and one of the original ones. It opens with a bunch of terrorists slaughtering people in an airport, and it's kind of fascinating how refractory it was of our times today. Obviously I didn't want to go there
yeah.
in the film, but it's interesting the actual footprints, origins of it.
You're saying that you've said already that there is no R-rated cut of this.
No.
There's no version
no.
you can stitch together with.
No.
crazy violence or anything like that?
No, absolutely not. It's a decision you make before you turn the cameras on. And, you know, you could easily make this R-rated by having two F-bombs. That'll do it. That's this. Or you have someone smoke a cigarette and now it's R-rated. But, you know, that's not what I think people mean when they ask for an R-rated version. You know, so it was always meant to be a PG-13 film.
Yeah. You have a dickhead, which I enjoyed as a first person.
Yes.
I wonder if it's like you have eight dickheads that add up to one F-bomb.
I believe there actually is some sort of Excel spreadsheet out there with the equivalencies of swear words.
I'd love to see that. And in terms of the, you know, it's called Suicide Squad. Two members of the squad don't make it out alive.
Correct.
Was it always those two? Or was there ever a third?
There was never a third. You know, it's pretty standard in the structure of all the Suicide Squad stories that, you know, somebody rebels against the system and gets executed by, you know, Amanda or Flag or something. So it was important to show the consequences. You're always wrestling with something like this of why would the bad guys play along? And, you know, the mechanism is these nanite charges that in their necks, which will blow their heads off. And, you know, part of the storyline is Joker engineering an escape for Harley by going to the inventor of these things and blackmailing him, forcing him to release Harley.
And am I right in thinking that the nanite bombs are manufactured by Wayne Corp?
Yes.
So they're Bruce. So Batman is involved in Suicide Squad, even though he may not know it.
Exactly. Well, look, Wayne Corp's a big company, and you know, Wayne Corp does have a history of weapons manufacturing and is something that's been around. So he has a diversified portfolio.
Because Amanda Waller is, in a way, the most interesting adversary for Batman, and this kind of sows the seeds for where that could go.
Yes.
She knows more than him, it seems.
Well, she knows what she knows. She's, you know, obviously an intelligence officer. And if you think about it, you know, if you start running down, you know, the logic trails of things, and you have this Batman figure acting as a vigilante, and at this point in time, he's been doing it, you know, for maybe 20 years. The government, the intelligence services would absolutely figure out who this guy is and where he comes from. You know, you'd put a freaking drone over Gotham City and just track the guy. I mean, why wouldn't you? It's only logical. And so, you know, Amanda Waller would somehow get this information.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting point.
She's, in many ways, I think, the most interesting character because she's so extreme. Is that essentially the secret to making anti-heroes work? When you're having to make people sympathetic towards sociopaths, you need the good guy to be even worse than they are.
Well, with Amanda, you know, when you read the comics, she's this fascinating character. I mean, she's so strong and so intimidating. And, you know, there's this sort of famous panel of she's chewing out Batman and has him backed against the wall as she sticks her finger in his face. And, you know, there's something fascinating about that that kind of character, and that she could wrangle these monsters. She has to be an apex predator in order to control them.
Was she a character that you look forward to whenever there was like an Amanda Waller day? I get that feeling from the film.
Yeah, no, I enjoy working with Viola, who's absolutely just a brilliant actor. And, you know, she's incredible at being this intimidating government official, and you could feel it when you do the scenes with the other actors. Is you know, they're definitely, they have this awe and respect for her. And again, I think maybe because she is such an incredibly gifted actor that you do feel it play in these scenes.
And you spring that twist about halfway through the film, whether or a bit later than that, where it's revealed that she is the target, the high value target.
Exactly. It's a mission movie. You know, it's you know, structurally, you know, you introduce the characters, you form the team, you know, pull them out of Bell Rev, send them on their mission. The mission is to basically, the movie is Amanda Waller covering up her mistake, because she was the one that decided to use Enchantress as a, you know, as part of the original sort of core Suicide Squad. So Enchantress is really the first Suicide Squad member. Amanda Waller deploys her to clean up, you know, this entity that appears, which unbeknownst to Amanda, is actually Enchantress's brother, and she's engineered the escape of this entity. So in the whole time, Enchantress has engineered her own escape. You know, it's funny because, you know, the plot gets dinged as being incredibly simple, but it's actually extremely complex. So Enchantress engineers her escape from Amanda Waller, and then Amanda Waller decides to cover it up by getting the hell, you know, having the Suicide Squad rescue her and get her out of that city.
We got to let you go, David. I just want to ask as a final question, there's that adversary of all the good guys, the prison guard played by Ike Barinholtz.
Yes.
He's from the Mindy Project.
Yes.
What the hell is on his browser history? The mind is reeling after that. It's a very funny line.
I think it's better left unsaid, isn't it? You know, I think he does a lot of eBay shopping.
Maybe involving ponies, but anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Cheers.
That was David Ayer. Helen, of course, just pointed out that I gave the spoiler warning after revealing the death of Slipknot, but, yeah, okay, it's all fine.
You could tell.
It's all good.
He wasn't in the group shots that were released like a year ago. It's all... was a shot the whole squad walking and he's not in the shot.
This is true. All right, so what we're going to do now is something quite unusual. I asked for questions from listeners for Suicide Squad questions, and I got sent tons via DM, via email, and I'm going to try and get through as many as we possibly can in the next 40 minutes or so. And you guys have not seen these, and I'm literally doing them at random. So this one is at Alex23Walker. How much do you think Suicide Squad would have benefited from being an 18? Deadpool-esque, if you will. Deadpool, of course, was a 15, but yeah, the point is taken.
Yeah, I think it might have helped in the sense that if you're going to portray people as bad guys, then you get to show them really being quite bad. On the other hand, I think they actually pushed it quite hard for a 12A, PG-13, whatever you want to call it. So I think you still got a sense of villainy here without having to show anything too graphic. And I think a lot of the time, the difference these days between a 12A and a 15 is just the amount of actual blood you show when someone is horribly killed. But someone still gets horribly killed in the 12A, so it's still quite tough, I think. I'm not sure how much as I'm a huge fan of casual swearing, as the guys here can attest, I'm not sure how much you would actually gain from a couple of extra F-bombs.
It's interesting, there's only one F-bomb in the movie I could detect, and that's in a song.
Mm. But that's the traditional limit for a PG-13 in the States, is one F-bomb.
It's interesting, no character says the F-bomb. If you go back to the extended edition, ultimate edition of Batman v Superman, they drop a F-bomb there. Scoot McNairy says the F-word.
There is a dickhead. Will Smith drops a dickhead, which I enjoyed.
On set, didn't you? You were privy to a lot of harsh language.
Yeah, I was actually. It was interesting because I had my own day, which is always nice because I think the actors are a bit less. When there's a big group of journalists, sometimes the actors are a little bit, you know, all very conscious of you being there. But when it's just you, sometimes they kind of forget you're there. And David Ayer, on the day, but I was there for the day where they were all in the Apache helicopter taking off, and David Ayer was trying to stoke up some rivalry between Joel Kinnaman and Will Smith, because they have a bit of a set to on the play. And he was getting Will Smith to swear his arse off and say things which I cannot repeat. So that was definitely the R-rated cut that I was watching them saying. And he was calling them all kinds of names, which none of which made it into the film. But that was interesting.
Wow, the Fresh Prince getting really fresh,
super fresh.
Super fresh.
But there is a point there contained within the tweet as well, I think, about the edginess of the film. And whether it's possible to have that kind of real raw edge in something that is designed to be PG-13. The idea of the film obviously is that it's the worst of the worst, but you're not allowed to see the worst of the worst doing the worst of the worst. So you have to take a lot of people's words for it, that Captain Boomerang is as bad as they say, that Harley Quinn is, you know, involved in the death of what we believe is the Jason Todd Robin, or that Deadshot has killed hundreds of people. No women or children.
He has his own code.
And only bad people. Mm. But you can't show that, really, in a PG-13. And maybe you don't show it because it's Will Smith and having to massacre a whole bunch of people at the beginning of the movie might be off-putting.
But you're right, though. It doesn't quite jibe with Harley, the portrayal of her in the movie, that she is involved in killing Robin. It doesn't feel like that's from the same...
It doesn't also throw up a couple of continuity problems, if she was?
Well, yeah, we were talking about this yesterday, that David Ayer told us in the interview you just listened to, that the Joker got the grill, the metal grill that he has in his mouth, because Batman punched his teeth out after he killed Robin. And then he gets it later, but...
And that's why the Joker then put damaged on his forehead.
Yeah, But then in the film, we get a flashback to him meeting Harley for the first time, and he's already got the grill. So presumably he's already killed Robin beforehand, in which case, how can Harley be involved in the killing of Robin? And my head's about to explode. But yeah, we were talking about this yesterday and how it doesn't quite make sense. It's a bit of a Mobius band.
Possibly, or then again, you have this sort of rinse and repeat, don't you, of Joker being caught, sent to prison, or Arkham gets out of Arkham, gets caught, gets sent back in again. That's something that, you know, I think you can get trapped in that cycle. So you might be able to explain it the way, possibly that way. No, you don't think so. Okay. No.
But
all right.
I tell you what, I think the edginess is interesting, though, because I think you do have a bit of an issue there because, like, for example, this is a different thing, but the premiere of this movie, the ticket said dress code edgy. And I'm like, if it's a code, can it really be edgy? Is that a contradiction in terms? And I feel like the film is a little bit of the same ilk. You know, if you are going to be a $100 million blockbuster, more than, how edgy can you get?
Yeah.
Because Deadpool was a tiny little film by these standards, you know.
Yeah, $40 million. But do you think that that edginess is a little bit insincere, perhaps?
Well, I think we can have a discussion about Harley's outfit, although I actually... That's not my biggest problem. So I think they actually handled the edginess as well as they probably could. I think David Ayer brought something to that and actually did okay there. I have bigger problems with the film, but it's not really that tone, I think, that I have an issue with.
I have to say, you know, I love End of Watch. I think that David Ayer is a very fascinating guy and an interesting talent. I've been on the record in the podcast as saying I hated Sabotage. I thought, you know, which is, I think, the film that's probably closest to this in terms of its tone and its style. And Fury, I thought, was very, very good. He has a lot of edge. He is a very interesting guy. He's done a lot. He's seen a lot. And I do wish, going back to the original question, I do wish that maybe the shackles have been taken off a little bit more. I do feel that there you can feel in this movie, you can feel different arguments going on between filmmaker perhaps and studio and perhaps people coming in. And I know there were a number of different editors in the film, and certainly the oft raised argument that the film starts three times or at least has three different introductions. And
you certainly feel some scenes trying to strain away from that PG-13 thing. And I think the scene, it's a bit controversial, but the scene with Common in the nightclub, the flashback with the Joker.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a controversial scene, but you feel like that belongs in an R-rated movie.
Yeah, you're right.
And then suddenly it goes back to being a PG-13. So there are scenes that don't quite feel like they're from the same film, to an extent.
That's true.
Okay, so another question now. This is from @SidLichtenstein. Probably not a real name. Hello, why was Diablo the only character with a clearly defined arc? Why wasn't an arc important for the others?
This is actually one of my biggest problems with the film. I thought they made the wrong character sympathetic. I did feel sympathetic towards Diablo. I liked him until I found exactly why he's so tortured and why he's so guilty. And I have kind of an issue with that because, for me, it just felt in bad taste. I don't have any problem with the hitman having a redemptive arc because there aren't a lot of hitmen in the world, actually. It's not really a thing outside of comics and TV and all the rest. I do kind of have a problem with a guy who kills his entire family being the most sympathetic figure in the film, because that happens too often and we as a society are awfully forgiving of it already. And I feel like if you keep forgiving it on screen and making him into essentially the tragic hero of the film, that just leaves a really bad taste in my mouth, because his family are only portrayed through his eyes and only, and it's his tragedy very much, not theirs, that we learn about. And I just thought that was in very bad taste, actually. I had a real issue with it.
Just to play devil's advocate or Diablo's advocate. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't as bothered by that. I can totally see where you're coming from, but I think it's made very clear that he's absolutely miserable, and it's a tale of redemption, and he's clearly done an awful, awful thing and feels racked with guilt and pain. And if he hadn't been racked with all those things, then I agree. But, and he does give his life as well for the squad, so that's kind of...
Yeah, but I mean, he you know, gets this second chance. Yeah. I think that's my kind of issue with it.
Isn't it set up very clearly, though, that it was an accident? He didn't intend to kill them. It's just power got out of control.
Yeah, but it always is. And I think that reflects real life as well. It's a little bit too close for comfort to me. I don't know. I think they thought all of those things. And I think that's why they have him in there. And that's why he gets his heroic self-sacrifice as some kind of redemption. But I don't think he was the character to redeem for me. And if you were going to redeem him, and that's not a story, by the way, that comes from the comics, is it? It's not something that's established as his backstory. So it's a choice that they've made. And they've made a choice to redeem the guy who kills his entire family in a moment of fury or rage or whatever, or loss of control. And it just feels like bad taste to me because it's too close to home.
I think this goes back, though, to the idea that they're pulling their punches with this movie quite a bit. You know, the worst of the worst. I mean, one of the models of the movie, right from the off, everyone was saying, the Dirty Dozen. If you go back to the Dirty Dozen, those are really bad dudes. They're murderers and rapists and thieves, and most of them are unrepentant, and most of them don't get redeemed. And I felt that this movie went out of its way to redeem people, and they weren't that bad to begin with. And the only one who was really bad was El Diablo. Mm. And even then, as you're right, it gets revealed to be a tragic mistake.
It's interesting with Killer Croc because, you know, I did a lot of interviews.
And, I keep forgetting about him.
Yeah, well, I think I was expecting him to be a bigger presence in the movie and get to do more. But certainly the backstory, his backstory is really, really dark. I talked to Adewale, the actor who plays him, and he was talking about how he ate his psychiatrist. He's a full-on cannibal, this character, and he's actually one of Batman's, you know, old time from the Rogues Gallery. And he's insane. He's like eaten dozens of people and is a monster, a true monster. But in the movie, they've kind of taken that away.
Yeah, they have very much. He doesn't come across as insane, and actually he doesn't come across as so monstrous. There's a lot of humanity to him and a lot of soul to him. But again, I almost have less problem with that because there aren't that many killer crocodile cannibal men, you know? So I'm kind of okay with, if they'd given him the redemptive arc, I kind of would have been okay with it, even though that, as you say, would be further from the comics.
The arc question is interesting because people do have arcs in the movie, but I guess you're right in saying that clearly defined arc. Deadshot starts the movie as... Well, it's interesting because we meet him post-arrest when we're told that Batman's the only person who could take him down, and then Batman basically just asks him to give himself up.
I wonder if some of the arc stuff could be answered if you think of this as part of a larger series of films.
Yeah.
And that I think they're clearly setting up Harley to break away from the Joker in a future film. I just don't think they wanted to do it. I think they changed their mind. David Ayer has even said that, you know, Harley's whole arc is to break away from the Joker and become like an independent person. That didn't happen in this film. I wonder if it was meant to happen at some point. I've heard rumours about the Joker being part of that climax with Enchantress at the end and coming to try and take Harley away, and she refuses and joins the squad and to save the world instead. I think that would have felt more satisfying.
Yeah, it would have very much. Because I think for me, the moment where she saves the squad came out of absolutely nowhere, like literally nowhere. There was no lead up to that. There was no build up to that. It didn't feel right at all. And you're right, if she had just rejected the Joker, actively rejected him, not just, oh, he's dead, that would have been a very different moment, and I think it would have worked a lot better.
Yeah, but I mean, Boomerang, I don't mind so much that he doesn't really have an arc. I think he's a fun kind of supporting character who just is who he is. He's unrepentant, although he does leave and then come back for no real apparent reason. But I kind of like that he's just a douchebag.
Got a question here from Robert Donnelly at That Rob Don, who says, do you think Harley Quinn was done well enough to deserve her own movie? And it's interesting because, you know, I'm not a huge fan of this film, but I really liked a lot of the performances in it.
Yeah.
Will Smith, I think, is very, very good. He brings up movie star charisma to what I think is an underwritten role. Margot Robbie, we've said from the off, looked like one of the greatest marriages of character and actor in any comic book movie. And I think that's proven to be the case. But the character herself, I know, Helen, you may have a couple of slight issues.
Really?
But do you think that Harley Quinn has done well enough to deserve her own movie? Now, that's certainly the direction they seem to be going in. Let's talk about that character. Let's talk about Harley Quinn.
Yeah, this is one of those frustrating cases where I really like the actor and the performance as related to the character. I didn't like what they did with the character. It's actually not a million miles from Henry Cavill's Superman. You know, I think he's fine as Superman. I just think they need a different Superman story for him. And with her, what she has to do in the sort of in the present day of the film is kind of not terrible, apart from that complete lack of a justification of an arc towards her big heroic moment at the end, which I genuinely thought came out of nowhere. Even her liking espresso was a bit random, but whatever. I think the problem with her was the dream sequences and the memories didn't make a lick of sense for that character, and they undermined her and made me less interested in her every single time that one came up. But I thought that there was a really nasty hint of sexualized violence in the flashbacks with the Joker. And again, I think this is part of what you're saying about, you know, pushing the edges of a PG-13, of a 12A, and then pulling back from it. I think that there's a lot of that in those scenes. So you see her being carried by the Joker's henchmen, I think legs apart, put on a table. It's a really horrible, horrible setup to a scene. And then, oh goody, the Joker's just going to torture her. It's not a gang rape. Fantastic. It's a really bizarre, unpleasant scene. And I think that's bad to begin with. And I get that the Joker tortured her. I get that that's part of her backstory. But it doesn't play well. And the only bit of that scene that plays well is the tiny glint in Robbie's eye, which suggests that she's kind of weird enough or kinky enough that she's not afraid of torture. That I thought, okay, there's an interesting thing here. And in her earlier scene with the Joker, there's that interesting thing where there's a gleam in her eye that there's something in her that responds to him in the first place. He's not entirely in control. She's allowing him to bring it out of her. And that's a really interesting way to play Harley Quinn. I thought that worked brilliantly. But they kept undermining that with everything else they did with the character. And it really frustrated me.
I've seen a lot of people throughout the years actually describe Harley Quinn as a problematic character.
She is,
Someone who is utterly enthralled to a man, you know, not just any man, the Joker, obviously, but she's subservient to him. She is completely dominated by him. She is actualized by him. You know, everything she does is for this guy.
But that's how she started off. It's not what the character is nowadays. And if you choose to portray her that way in the film, it's a choice you have made. I mean, she didn't join the Suicide Squad until 2011, by which time she had a lot of development already in the animated series and in the comics. Yeah. So you have chosen to portray her as still under the thumb. And even if, as you say, Nick, he's planning on sort of emancipating her in a future issue, I don't think that's the right choice. I think you should have given her more of that to begin with, because otherwise it kind of comes out of nowhere.
I wanted more Harleen Quinzel, who is obviously the pre-Harley version of this character, and I think that was essential for this film to show her transformation, and I thought it was done very half-heartedly. It was done in a series of quite confusing flashbacks, and you got that one scene with her sitting opposite a table where she's wearing her kind of white coat, and then it's over in a flash.
Yeah. There was more time of her walking to that table and showing her legs than there was actually facing the Joker as his psychiatrist.
And I thought that needed to sit. That needed to be a five-minute scene. Or let's have her meeting the Joker for the first time. And that surely is a fascinating thing to watch.
Yeah.
The very first meeting of these two characters. But instead it's done as kind of two lines of dialogue and then we're off.
I just didn't think they had a good enough grip on what she is and what she should be to make that scene work, I think. And then the other thing is like her dream sequence makes not a lick of sense.
Well,
by that point, she is Harley Quinn. And by that point, her dream is not a pure suburban fantasy. It may well be a fantasy involving the Joker, but there should be some tweaks to that world. There should be something askew in that dream because she is meant to be mad by that point.
Yeah, I remember watching that and going, so Harley Quinn's ultimate ideal is to be married with kids to a normal version of the Joker.
Yeah.
I think Helen may have something to say about that. I was thinking that at the time. But, you know, I think Robbie's a lot of fun in the role. I think Harley Quinn in the movie is a lot of fun. Her delivery of lines is pitch perfect. You could, of course, argue, and this is something that a lot of people have said about this movie, that the team that Amanda Waller recruits to stop the next Superman, should the next Superman turn out to be a despot, includes just one superpowered person and a woman with a hammer.
You've got to have boomerangs.
A woman with a hammer, a man with a boomerang, a good shot. Who am I missing? Who else? The lady with the sword that takes people's souls.
Katana.
Ah, yes.
Which is completely, you know, like, oh yeah, that's normal.
I like that.
Rick Flag and his incredible change in hair length.
You forgot GQ.
I did. Well, he's part of Rick Flag's team. He's not part of the Suicide Squad, so you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But oh, and I forgot Killer Croc again. You know, GQ, of course. Much missed. His sacrifice.
Did he definitely die? Are we sure of this? Because if you didn't see it...
He was an inch away from a bomb as it exploded.
I know, but maybe it like explodes upwards or something. There's going to be some nonsensical thing. And can we talk about this plan? Because their big plan is to completely ignore Enchantress and try and take down the bloke with her. And then... profit? I mean, they just haven't... There's a middle step there that they just
I think they see immediately that he is the guy. It's like you get into the situation very, very quickly as a hero slash villain slash anti-hero, and you very quickly learn to evaluate who's got the worst CG. And whoever's got the worst CG tends to be the big bad guy.
Okay.
Because they haven't had the time to work on it, I'm guessing. So you go for him.
Right.
And you get rid of him. And then it all...
It's amazing that they're able to make that decision. Really, isn't it?
These are trained
specialists,
Helen.
Yeah. It's ultimately a very, 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 very silly setup to this film, isn't it? This squad, the idea of this being the squad that they pick, doesn't make a lick of sense. You have to either get on board with that or not. I kind of, that's not one of the things that bothers me, to be honest. I kind of think it's all right, there's a guy called Boomerang who throws, really good at throwing boomerangs. He should have been the guy who throws the bomb at the end. Someone else pointed that out, and I went, yeah.
That's a good point, yeah.
There's a big moment where someone throws something at the climax of the film, and it's not the guy called Boomerang.
But then what does Deadpool have to do? Maybe what you should have had is
Deadpool?
Sorry.
Deadshot.
What they should have maybe had there at that moment is a sort of Ant-Man and Captain America throwing the water truck kind of a moment.
You needed more teamwork.
Exactly.
But hey, they're not very good at teamwork. Maybe the next one they'll be really good at.
But someone else pointed out, Sam Asher has pointed out, who is, I think, the only person I know who unequivocally loves this film. That's interesting. So shout out to Sam. He pointed out that Killer Croc is the only member of the team who has the strength to throw the bomb thing into the portal thing to blow up the thing.
Machine?
That's the one. And that Captain Boomerang, he might have thrown it with unerring accuracy, but he might have fallen 50 feet short.
I think you're underestimating his throwing arm. That guy is constantly holding up beer cans, and he's surely got a really pumped up bicep. By the way, Boomerang's type of beer is a brand made up for the film, which is called Gurgler's Ale.
Gurgler's Ale.
Yeah, and right. Harley Quinn's chewing gum is called Everchew.
Interesting. So what do we think of them? You know, a lot of people have asked about the multiple introductions to the movie and how the squad are introduced. I thought that it was going to be the situation where Batman apprehended all of them and put them in Belrive. But that wasn't... I wonder if the inclusion of the Flash was a quite late one.
It's one of these things where you kind of have a version of the movie in your head, and for some reason I kind of thought, I got it in my head, like, how cool would it be if this movie started with Bruce Wayne being taken on a tour of Belrive, and he's hunting for people with special powers at this point, so he's checking them out, and that's how you... It doesn't need to be Bruce Wayne, it just needs to be someone going to Belrive and being introduced cell by cell to these guys, and that seems like a very neat way of introducing you to this, the world of this insane prison. And I thought it was a little bit ADD and in
effect those two scenes together. So on one hand you've got Amanda Waller introducing them, on the other hand you've got the sort of montage going around the prison. Why not just put the two together? Right,
I don't know, and it would make sense for Bruce Wayne to do it, because then you'd have a great, you know, some great dialogue with him and Amanda Waller, and I don't know. So I wasn't entirely thrilled. It felt a bit workmanlike the way they did it, and also a bit inefficient.
I think the Flash thing was because Captain Boomerang is traditionally a Flash villain, so they thought they'd bring him in and give him something to do, give him a little moment.
Yeah.
Judging by Ezra Miller's little tiny bit we saw in the trailer for Justice League, it might have been fun to give him more of a fun moment, but, you know, hey,
I didn't catch what he said. Did anyone catch what he said?
I'll be honest, I saw it at the premiere and the sound was so bad I could barely catch half of what the Joker was saying either.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting that they gave other things for, you know, a member of the Justice League to do. Maybe it would have been nice to have a uniform Batman running through the characters. And I think maybe that was the plan, because I believe that's the shot that Zack Snyder directed, am I right?
The Flash moment, yeah.
Yeah, that's the sequence that Zack Snyder directed. But yeah, I feel that the movie also started with Amanda Waller in the restaurant with David Harbour and the other guy talking about the squad and introducing them one at a time. And we're going back to this idea. We know that there were issues on the movie in terms of different voices and different factions, and I wonder if the introduction of Deadshot and Harley Quinn before the movie really begins was a result of that. Question from at Mr. Jeremy Dillon, who asks, if each character could only be introduced once, this is just fits into it, how would you have opened the film? I mean, how would you have done it?
I like Nick's idea, let's do that.
Bruce Wayne?
Yeah.
Reshoots.
Yeah,
it's not too late, is it?
Get Ben Affleck in. I mean, that takes us on to the mid-credit sting, which is interesting because I believe it was about a year ago where DC said that we would not do that. That is the Marvel thing. I'm not sure if it was an official statement or not, but certainly someone high up within the DC movies said, we're not doing that. That's Marvel's territory and we're going to do that. And now they're doing it, which I thought was interesting. What do we make of that? A lot of people have sent in questions along the lines of, does it make sense that Bruce Wayne would be meeting Amanda Waller when he already has a lot of information?
He's after the hard copies.
Yeah, I was just a bit confused about that.
He hasn't got a
printer. So is he, I mean, are we meant to think that she's giving him the information and then erasing it? Or is he just trying to check how much the government knows? Or what is the point of that?
She seems to have things that he certainly, you know, we don't know how much Lex Luthor had in his files that, yes, that Bruce got at the end of Batman Superman or during Batman Superman.
I mean, he'd made up their logos, but he maybe didn't know their names.
He'd given them logos, but yeah, that's the thing. But did he know who they were?
I think he probably
so
did. But
Amanda,
okay,
Waller seems to have names and addresses and social security numbers for, you know, Arthur Curry and Barry Allen, and June Moore was in there as well. Enchantress, mm-hmm, I believe, at the beginning. But I don't know. I wonder if Amanda Waller is a bit too evil to function in within. You know, there's murkiness and a moral murkiness in terms of who Bruce Wayne has to talk with and deal with in order to get the Justice League up and running.
You have to assume that she is so devious that she presents a face that is less evil, yeah, than we, yeah, see her in the film.
Yeah.
We only see her being scheming and Machiavellian, but you've got to presume she on the surface is a high-up government person who, mm, Bruce Wayne would not.
And she is scheming and Machiavellian towards baddens, so she may be an absolute honey pie towards nice people.
She doesn't seem to be, though. She basically,
well, no, she doesn't.
She seems to very strongly imply that she knows how Bruce spends his nights.
I liked that line. You've got to stop working nights or whatever.
Yeah, but
it was.
So I was confused. I mean, is there anyone in this universe who doesn't know who Bruce Wayne is?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, Zack Snyder on the spoiler special for Batman Superman, yeah, basically said that he thinks secret identities in universes like this are daft. And, you know, let's not talk too much about the other company across the street, but certainly in the Marvel universe, by and large, secret identities fell by the wayside almost immediately with Iron Man. Only Spider-Man and Daredevil in that universe now maintain secret identities. In this universe, I don't know. I think, Bruce Wayne, from what we've understood of Justice League so far in the trailer, seems to be fairly openly as Bruce Wayne going around recruiting these super types. So you do wonder how much he's hiding his big bat light under a bat bushel.
That's very true. That's very true.
I think maybe they're going to move away from it a little bit.
Well, presumably, I guess it makes sense for there to be a meta-human exception, so he can talk to the people he's actually working with, and he
doesn't
have to.
But I guess he's giving away to Waller, though, in this scene. But yeah. No, I quite liked the scene. I thought it was fine. As I said, I'd prefer to have seen them meet up in the meat of the film, rather than tacked on as a way to get people to start screaming in the cinema at the end. It just felt a little bit cynical. But I think it would have been a lot more effective if we hadn't seen the Justice League footage, with him at a much more advanced stage actually meeting the Justice League, and now we're going backwards to him getting files on them, and so you're kind of sitting there going, why are we watching this? We've seen.
And couldn't he find them from the footage he has? I mean, he's the world's greatest detective.
And why
Come
was
on.
The photo of Aquaman not him with the trident poking, destroying the camera? That would have been the flip side of what we saw at the end of Batman Superman. So it was moderately good.
Moderately successful.
Moderately good.
Always good to see Ben Affleck.
Yeah. I really like his Batman. That was one of my things I had no problem with in Batman v Superman. Justice.
At Lego Godzilla, Graham asks, how come there were no sign of good metahumans trying to take down Enchantress and her CG brother? Seems like a world-ending event would attract Wonder Woman, Batman, or Flash.
Yeah, I was wondering about Flash as well. I mean, you know, presumably he's napping or something. I have no idea. They're presumably going to explain that away with a line somewhere in Justice League.
I'll be honest with you, I'm not entirely sure what Enchantress was trying to do.
Well, she was making a machine because humanity worships machines now instead of her, so she's jealous, so she makes her own, and it hoovers up destroyers.
Turns people into blackcurrants, and it makes a laser show. It's very hard to discern that.
It was bad. It was definitely bad.
It was definitely not a good thing. Although, you know, multilateral disarmament, I mean, has a lot to be said for it. So.
But
I'm with her.
Weirdly, that was more of a Ghostbusters reboot than the Ghostbusters reboot we got a few months ago.
This is true. But again, this is a question that pertains to the other lot as well. When you get solo movies and you go, well, why is that character batting this huge threat on his own when he could just pick up the phone and get the bloke with the armor to come along and help him out? And it, you know, obviously, from a filmmaking point of view, it's not that easy. But I wonder about that.
Yeah, we have to leave them at.
But the world-ending event in this movie is kind of treated almost as an afterthought. The crux of the squad's mission in certainly the second act is to rescue someone, and that's the thing. Meanwhile, there's this thing that could potentially end the world. We don't know. You're right. There might be just more BlackBerry production. Who knows? And they seem to be ignoring that until the very end.
I didn't get immediately that they were going in to rescue a person. They talked about I think I'm right in saying
a code name.
Yeah, and I thought that was just the code name for Enchantress and that they were going after Enchantress. I was not clear that it was a rescue mission at all, essentially until after they were in that building.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just me being stupid. But
I was clear, but then again, I was on set for the day where they were filming something explaining that. So
Did you know who it was? Because I've seen a lot of people express that they were surprised when it turned out to be Waller.
It was intended to be a surprise, and it was a surprise.
Yeah, it was. It was a surprise.
I won't say that it was necessarily the greatest surprise in terms of making you excited, because I was kind of, your mind starts going, who is it? Who is it? And then it's like, it's that character we met.
Yeah,
half an hour ago. Yeah, we've seen loads of already in the film.
I actually wondered. I wondered if it might have been, at some point, Lex Luthor. Because I thought there is a character that he could have as part of his deal with the government to maybe get out of Arkham a little bit, because he knows a lot of shit now, Lex. He's got a lot of info, a lot of intel, and maybe he is working high up in the government, and maybe he was the guy that they needed to get out, because you got to keep that brain box intact. And then he would have been interesting in a dynamic with the squad themselves, because he's worse than any of them, basically.
Or what if it had been Alfred?
Alfred.
That he's locked himself in a room and he can't get out.
He can't get out. Yeah.
And he's got loads of ironing to do.
I can't find the handle, Master Bruce. I'm terribly sorry. But it's not Luther. We know it's not Luther. We know it was never meant to be Luther. Or maybe it was. Who knows? But that does raise the interesting idea about interactions with the squad, which brings us to the Joker. Now, do you think, Nick, you probably know this better than anyone apart from people who worked in the film, was Joker at any point meant to interact with the Suicide Squad?
Like I said, I'm pretty sure he was going to turn up at the end of the film, not least because in some of the trailers we get a glimpse of him in a tux with his face burned on one side, clearly post-helicopter crash, with a gun. And from what I've heard, he was intended to show up and start lobbing grenades and have a bit of a showdown with the squad and then try and get Harley on his side. That didn't make it into the film. I'm not entirely sure why. Jared Leto's obviously said that 10 minutes of footage is not made it into the film of what he did. I don't know why, but yeah, I think there must have been some more interaction.
Yeah. Now, there's a school of thought as well that, as interesting as Leto's take on the Joker is, I don't think he's up there with Heath Ledger or Jack Nicholson, but certainly he brings something to this role. It's a different version.
Mm. Yep.
You either go all in or you skip completely, because if you take the Joker out of the movie, apart from the end when he rescues Harley Quinn from Bell Rev, how does he affect the plot?
Well, he steals the helicopter, so they have to walk.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah.
They have to walk.
By taking out his appearance at the end of the movie, if it was filmed, and we have reason to believe it was, where he comes in and then forces Harley to make that decision to, reclaim, this is such a wanky Dr. Phil term, but, reclaim ownership of herself, without that, then basically could you have cut him out of the movie? Or do you keep him in the movie because he's the reason everyone gets excited about it? Oh, it's a new Joker, it's a Joker, it's a Joker.
I do wonder if, when you say that, I wonder if maybe if the Joker had only shown up in that final scene and we had only heard about him obliquely until then, and you just have that final scene where there's revealed this is the Joker and he's coming to break Harley out, and that's literally the first time you see him is when he takes off the SWAT helmet.
People
would have gone insane.
Yeah.
And they would have gone, holy shit, and he would have had, one line?
Yeah.
And he would have walked out the film, the film would have finished, and people would have gone, fuck, I can't wait to see the next one.
I genuinely think
they should have done that.
Yeah.
Because one of my big problems, actually, is I've been talking a lot about The Dark Knight recently, since I saw Suicide Squad, and I just think the way Nolan treated that character was the right way. You have to build him up, you have to give him a big entrance, you have to treat him with respect. And I thought this film just threw him into the mix in the middle of a kind of a montage of flashbacks. And he was just suddenly in the film even his first shot was just him at a table with a two shot and not particularly lit dramatically or anything. And I just thought they've not put the Joker in this film in the right way.
Yeah, I hated that scene as well. But I find it confusing, badly shot, and obviously really, really misconceived, that scene in the nightclub with Harley. But I mean, he's a very, very, very creepy Joker. He is recognisably the Joker and yet a different version than we've seen before, which is no mean feat on its own. I'm not sure it was worth the months of psychological torture of everyone around him.
That's the thing now. You watch the movie now and imagine that you were somebody who was sent a live rat or worse by Jared Leto, and then you have no scenes of them. You'd be going, what?
To be fair, that rat is now scampering around Guillermo del Toro's mansion, so that rat has had its life immeasurably enhanced by Jared Leto's method acting. But I didn't have any problem with Leto. I thought I'm yet to be completely sold on what he's doing. But
I'm interested to see what he does in a future film. If Ben Affleck's Batman film happens, when that happens, if he's in that, I'd be interested to see what he does with it. And I think it'd be interesting to see a real face off between his Joker and Batman.
Yeah. I think Nick, you should have written this film. that's two good ideas so far.
Well, the last thing about the Joker I have to say is I don't think he was jokey enough. I think he was perfectly sane, and everything he did was part of a completely rational plan, and he was just going, right, I've got to do this, so I'm going to do that and that. And there was no sense of the play the twisted...
I guess the most twisted thing he does is in that scene with Common in the nightclub where he's like, oh, you like my girl? Take my girl. And then, what are you taking my girl for? And then he kills him. That's, you know, and then even the bit where, I think a lot of people have talked about this, the birth of Harley Quinn sequence where he throws her into the vat of chemicals.
They call it the chemical wedding.
She dives into
the call it the chemical wedding.
The chemical wedding. Okay.
That was the name of the scene.
And then he's like, oh, what do I do? What do I do? I'm so creepy and kooky. But I love her. Diving after her. And that's basically, you know, that's kind of like a rational, normal thought process for a mad psychopath, admittedly, but still.
I didn't get that scene, really. I got that he was putting her in the same chemical vat stuff that he, blah, blah, blah. But why the hesitation to jump? After her, why then jump after her? What was that meant to convey?
I don't know. And it is the least corrosive acid in the world.
Yes, it's like... clearly not an... It mustn't be an acid, but it destroys their clothes.
Yeah.
At least destroys the dye in their clothes. It's very strange.
Yeah, my feeling with that is that she dives in.
Yeah.
She doesn't immediately reappear. And so he starts to think, oh, okay, well, I've written it off, you know, and this clearly she's dead and that wasn't meant to be. And then you go, oh, actually, no, I quite... like her? Do I love her?
You seen her? She looks like Margot Robbie. Oh, my God.
I should dive in after her. And then he...
I did like his laugh.
Yep.
I gotta give him props for the laugh.
Yep, good props for the laugh. And also his incredible organisational skills. Not only is he able to, you know, mount this incredible rescue of Harley Quinn, which seems a lot more bothered than just what he does at the end of the movie, which is, you know where she is in Belle Reve, just go and get her, you know, rather than bribing Ike Barinholtz's guard, one of my favourite things about the movie, by the way, and then mounting this elaborate plan. But also, though, just the way he puts all his knives and machetes and guns around himself in that scene, or, you know, the scene talking about?
Yeah.
This is a man who's clearly dedicated to being, you know, just very... organized.
And, but also, like, it's a creepy scene because it's not just knives and guns. There's, like, baby grows and stuff.
Onesies, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
no,
that
right
scene
yet.
Is based on a pink scene from Pink Floyd's The Wall.
Yeah.
I did not notice that.
But,
that's creepy.
Yeah, I just don't know if you quite creepy get the man. Glee that you get with Heath Ledger's Joker and actually Jack Nicholson's as well, and, of course, Cesar Romero, but you get the sense that heist scene at the beginning of The Dark Knight, you can imagine him working that out and just cackling and going, this is going to be amazing.
This Joker is a bit too cool to caper, I feel. And I feel that the Joker should be capable of capering. And that's hard to say.
A capricious clown prince of crime.
Capering.
Capering capable.
Okay. Capering capably through the Cape Crusaders. Okay, anyway. But yeah, I love that idea. Imagine how people would have reacted had you had all this ballyhoo and all this fanfare about Jared Leto playing the Joker, and you watch Suicide Squad and he turns up for one shot at the end of the movie.
A sort of the Mark Hamill, if you will.
The Mark Hamill, if you will. Absolutely. But like doing press and like talking about how insane he was and literally knowing he's all this time he's in one shot. That would
so
have been
wait,
awesome.
If he was actually joking about all the stuff he did, that makes me like him like a million times more. I'm right back up there to Jordan Catalano levels of liking Jared.
He is the Joker.
He's joking.
Should have seen it coming.
We have another question. This is from @SeanGilbody2, who asks, do you think the film would have been much different if Tom Hardy had been Rick Flagg? Tom Hardy initially had been cast as Rick Flagg, in case you weren't aware, and then he dropped out, I think because of The Revenant. I think The Revenant overran, and it meant he couldn't do Suicide Squad. So they looked at a list of people to replace him, and eventually they came to Joel Kinnaman. And there we go.
I quite like Joel Kinnaman.
I think he's a black hole of charisma. But that neither.
Harsh.
Well,
he's great in The Killing.
I think he's much taller than Tom Hardy. And I think he's much more. He enunciates much better. So he has that going for him over Tom Hardy. It would have been a different. You're right. It would have been a very different film with Tom Hardy in that role.
I think I can imagine Tom Hardy easily playing. Obviously, he's not Australian, but. You know, the thing Jai Courtney was doing with Boomerang was Tom Hardy-esque in a
it
way.
It was very much, yeah.
He had a Tom Hardy vibe to him. So I think that as much as I, you know, would have liked to have seen Tom Hardy being the guy who's trying to keep this under control, I'm not sure he's quite right for that straight arrow.
It is a bit too straight for him, isn't it, I think?
He might have given it a kink and maybe a quirk. He's capable of doing straight.
I don't think he's, you know. No, I'm not saying he's not, but it's not what he's been specialising in over the last couple of years.
But also, I think those scenes would have been given an extra frisson. You know, and you have this kind of weird bromance between Deadshot and Flag. And I just wonder if it had been two A-list actors, properly A-list, going at each other, so to speak, whether that would have had a little bit more oomph to it than Will Smith utterly dominating Joel Kinnaman in all their scenes together.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But I didn't hate Kinnaman. I thought he was fine.
I don't hate him. He's there. I mean, there's no doubt about it. He's there. Here's a big one. This is from @redflossed. Do you think that if the marketing campaign has stuck with the angle it was going for in the first trailer, it might have helped to manage people's expectations instead of instilling everybody with the Guardians of the Galaxy vibe? Should DC have stuck to their guns and gone for something darker instead of forcing the lightheartedness of it all? Okay, so this is something we kind of glossed over. The movie did gangbusters in the US in its opening weekend with $135 million opening weekend. Not maybe quite as much as they had initially been predicting. At one point, it looked like it might outgross Batman v Superman's opening weekend. Didn't do that. But at the same time, let's be honest, this movie's been given a critical mauling. Not across the board, but I think it's about 30% something like that in Rotten Tomatoes. And honestly, the questions I was sent on DM, and indeed the Empire podcast email address, most of them are, I'd say 99% are overwhelmingly negative about the film. And maybe, does that stem from expectations? Does that stem from the first trailer, which did have that, oh, this could be really fun, Guardians type thing?
The first act of the film kind of has that same vibe, though, as much as people have been complaining about the redundancy of some of the, you know, the fifth introduction to Will Smith or whatever. It's got some of that fun, and it's got the, you know, the oh, look, Deadshot uses a potato gun, and all those facts that are flashing up on the screen, and, okay, the musical choices are not always fantastic, but it has some of that vibe to it, and I think maybe what people are reacting to with the anger that everyone kind of seems to have about this film at the moment is that it turns into a very generic superhero film in the third act, and it feels indistinguishable from, you know, an X-Men film. It's just a big supernatural force with a generic army of minions, and it just falls into formula, and I think people were really hoping that this would do its own thing and do something different.
In the same way that not Deadshot but Deadpool did earlier this year, the reason that was as much of a success as it was is because everybody was like, oh, thank goodness this one is different. And I think that's the issue right now. Everybody wants a different twist on it. And I think the reason that the other company have been as successful as they are is that to a large extent they have managed to make each film feel like its own thing. And this, you know, looked in those trailers very much like its own thing. It looked completely different from Man of Steel, completely different from Batman v Superman, I think got us all quite hopeful and excited.
It did feel like Guardians. The trailer, the first trailer.
But in terms of the film, you know, Deadpool has a flippancy right up until the end.
Yeah.
And they keep busting out ridiculous things. And Guardians has a dance-off at the end. And so they are sort of subverting things and doing funny little twists on stuff. Whereas I feel with Suicide Squad, by the end, you've got quite a generic film, which is going for emotion for these characters that I don't feel they've really earned. And it just feels a bit sort of maudlin and a bit like, I don't really care about June Moon and Rick Flagg's romance so much. You know, you want something funny and silly and anarchic going on.
Can we just talk about June Moon, really?
Great name.
Come on.
Ace archaeologist June Moon. What does this thing do? This ancient thing? I'll break this head off.
I wanted to ask David Ayer about that, but I was too scared.
He's quite
scary. He can be.
Breaking the head off did seem like a bad idea. The musical choices for me were, some great songs, some of my favourites in there, but like, dude, can I please have them less on the nose?
Can I say what my interpretation of the flipping the head off of the statue? I feel like she was under a slight spell at that point
already before opening the statue.
That's what I took from it, was that she picks up this thing and there's a bit of spooky music, and I felt like Enchantress was kind of taking her over already her do it. So that's my defence. I don't know if that's what they had in mind, because somebody must have said something about that scene, surely.
Because somewhere in her archaeology training, she must have been told not to break the head off ancient statues. Like, that's probably in there.
And
somewhere.
Where was the buddy system? Where was the buddy? Even Indy took, you know, Alfred Molina into a temple. You don't go in on your own.
We don't know what June Moon went through to get to that temple. Everyone may have died. Her Alfred Molina may already be dead.
You want to see a prequel? Oh.
I didn't say that. I did not say
that. Demanding one.
I am demanding one. So, yeah, but just going back to this idea of expectations, and again, there was a great Hollywood Reporter article about how the movie may indeed have been compromised by the reaction to that first trailer, which seems to have taken elements that the footage from the movie that was being shot at the time and imposed upon it a tone that the movie, as written and directed by David Ayer, did not have. Mm. It was meant to be darker. It was meant to be grittier. It was meant to be, there's that word again, edgier. And then everyone went, oh, this is DC's Guardians. This is going to be fun and irreverent and yeah, great. And with people who are bad doing good things. And so then they had to work to retcon the movie to include all that fun irreverent stuff, hence the reshoots and rewrites. And also you wonder how much of it is a reaction to the reception afforded to Batman Superman, which again was a very, very dark, oppressive movie. And maybe they thought, well, hang on, if we do two in a year and we can't, it's not going
to
work.
But I think the fun bits were the way to go. I think those were the bits that worked for me.
I agree.
So to the extent that it's led to this unevenness of tone, which I think you're probably right about, then maybe they should have just gone further. I don't know.
There was one scene I saw them filming on the Chinook again where Killer Croc pukes up all this disgusting, like, half-digested goat meat, because he eats goat carcasses in his cell, and pukes it up all over the floor of the Chinook, and then scoops it up and puts it back in his mouth and re-eats it. And David Ayer hadn't told anyone this was going to happen, none of the other actors, so people were just going, like, looking really repulsed. And it looked great, and I don't know why they cut that, because what you're left with is quite a serious just exposition chunk on there.
Yeah.
It gives Killer Croc a great moment. Interestingly, I was on the set of Sabotage as well, which you were talking about earlier.
Yeah,
there was
a
scene in that where, near the beginning of the movie, where Sam Worthington has to hide something in a toilet and he pulls out a big... I watched him pulling out this big prop poo and it was absolutely disgusting. It was going all over him, and that got cut from the film as well. So David Ayer doesn't have much luck with the body fluid stuff. Seems to keep getting cut.
But they're saying that there won't be like a Batman Superman type situation where we get the extra 30-40 minutes. This seems to be it in terms of Suicide Squad. Mm. A few people have asked, where did DC go from here? And it's an interesting one, because this movie will make a lot of money. Will it make more than Batman Superman? It depends on how it holds up over the next few weeks. At the moment, I think it seems on course to hit anywhere between 600 million and 900 million. It's too early to call at this point. So it's a commercial success.
Mm.
But do they listen to critical reaction? Do they listen to people who may be disappointed, audience members who may be disappointed having seen it the first time? Or do they stay the course? Do they stick with what they're doing and carry on?
Well, first of all, next thing up is Wonder Woman, which I think is a very different kettle of fish and a very different proposition.
You don't think she'll puke up and then eat it?
I don't think she'll puke up and then eat it. And I'm still super, super excited for that one, because I think it's a chance to kind of find this tone that's been maybe a little bit elusive for these last two films. So I think that could be the sort of the way into this universe that they've been just struggling a little bit to completely find, and I'm hoping that that's going to be it. But I think they have proven themselves very willing so far to kind of listen. I think every single one of these films so far, we've been told, will be different from the last, essentially. Reading between the lines of what people say, they've taken on board the criticisms of Man of Steel. They took on board the criticisms of Batman Superman for this one. They are listening to people and to the fans and to the critics, however much David Ayer says that they're not. They are listening. And I think, you know, it's just a question of how much they can do. And I suppose the worry of all that is that they listen to all these voices. The pressure is obviously growing from the very difficult birth of this film. We see that there's a lot of different competing voices trying to be heard in the production of these films, and that itself could undermine the films. But I don't think they can be accused of not taking on board all the criticism.
Also, what seems to have happened in the last few months is that Geoff Johns seems to have assumed control, or been given control, or become the Kevin Feige figure at DC and Warner Brothers that I think they need. I think you have too many cooks. Clearly, the broth ain't always going to come out okay. I think you do need that central figurehead who gets DC, which Geoff Johns clearly does, and hopefully this, you know, they can move in the right direction. Because you know, again, we go back to this idea. People say, are there too many comic book movies? I think no, there aren't too many comic book movies. There have been, what, five this year? Okay, that's out of hundreds of movies. Proportionally, we're okay. But what I think we're at the point now where in the last year or so we've had too many bad comic book movies. Mm. And I think if we can move, if DC can move forward in a way with Geoff Johns at the head, hopefully increase the quality of what they're doing, hopefully Marvel can keep their streak going, then we'll be in a good place. Because, you know, Fantastic Four, X-Men Apocalypse, you know, Batman Superman Despite Us, you know, has its flaws, and this movie, that's not a great batting average for the last year, I'd say.
Yeah, and I think this is a, Suicide Squad is a scrappy movie, it's a messy mm-hmm. movie, but I think there's a huge amount of potential. I'd happily yeah. see mm. another film with these characters. I think they need to work on finding an adversary for them that matches them, and I think maybe they could go in a sillier direction with the adversary, you know, not just a straightforward, oh, I'm destroying the world kind of thing. But yeah. I'd happily see these characters again.
I would too. I agree. I had no problem with the casting of these characters. I thought some of the performances were fantastic. We haven't talked about a lot about Will Smith, and that's kind of because what is there to say? He's Will Smith. Mm. He does a really good job with whatever he's given. And I think his charisma, along with Robbie's charisma, was just central at the heart of the film. If you just have, if even just those two, plus maybe a little bit of comic relief from Boomerang, like, that's you set up. You do, you know, the rest can come or go as you please.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, yeah, I'd love to see more Will Smith and Ben Affleck, more Will Smith and the Joker. He's very, very good, as I said earlier on, in a slightly, I think, underwritten mm. role. He's so good, in fact, playing a character that I don't really think we've seen him play recently. If you look at this and Focus as well, again, where he was had this amazing chemistry with Margot Robbie. Yeah, I know a lot of people don't like that film, but I thought it was perfectly, perfectly decent. If you look at him, he's playing now slightly more immoral characters, and what this movie did for me, especially in the first 10 minutes when he's on the phone and he's, you know, negotiating with that guy and going, no, don't kill this guy unless you give me $1 million, and now you have to give me another $1 million for insulting me, and I was just thinking, man, why did you turn down Django Unchained? That's what I was thinking. That's all I could think. It's like, this Will Smith in that movie, as good as Jamie Foxx is in that film, would have just destroyed it. I just, you know, it's a bit sad. But, you know, we talked earlier on in the year about had he made the right decision to pass on Independence Day Resurgence to go for Suicide Squad. And, you know, I mean, I wasn't sure. And yeah, he did. he made the right decision.
And I think they have to bring Adam Beach back. He hasn't had enough of a go. But bring him back as his Slipknot's twin brother, Sheepshank. I just looked up a list of knots. Double bowline.
Double bowline, yes.
Because, yeah, poor Adam Beach. I talked to him on set, and he apparently spent weeks learning all these different types of knots and learning how to rope, de-ropes.
Poor guy.
We needed more knot, more rope knotting.
He's a good, I like him. He's a good actor as well.
He's a very nice guy.
Atmos Dalaga asked a load of questions that we've kind of covered. But he also said, is Slipknot's superpower, which from what I could tell was that he owned some rope, the single worst superpower ever featured in a non-comedy film?
Well, there's that ADR line, the Joel Kinnaman line from off screen, that just goes, this is Slipknot, he can climb anything, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Can he climb anything?
What do we think of his death, though? I know it didn't quite work as the big moment it was meant to be, but I think, quite liked it established the stakes, you know what I mean?
I think you did have to kill somebody. I don't know that you necessarily had to kill somebody quite so ignominiously. I think you could have, like, almost brought in someone almost unnamed and just killed them, but maybe that's what they thought they were doing with Slipknot. But yeah, I did kind of want to him to stick around, because I like Adam Beach. I think he's a good actor, and I thought, oh, he's one of the squad, great. Yeah, because I'd obviously missed that picture a year ago, Nick.
So. Yeah, well, he is introduced punching a woman in the face and saying she's got a mouth on her.
Yeah, he's also meant to be a bad guy. So.
Yeah, yeah. And according to Adam Beach, his Slipknot's backstory is he was caught strangling Wonder Woman. So maybe it's just as well he got his head blown up.
It maybe is, yeah. He's.
That's not the canon backstory. Yeah. David Ayer didn't seem to know about that.
A lot of violence towards women in this film, and a lot of really disturbing laughter when Batman punches Harley Quinn. Like the screening I saw it in, that got a big laugh, and I wasn't massively comfortable with that. But, you know, hey. Mm-hmm.
At Sarah_Katie asks, who shot down the helicopter the flag and company took into Midway City? Did I miss something, or was that never actually explained?
I thought it was Enchantress's brother. I thought it was Incubus.
I don't remember who did it. I don't remember it. I thought Incubus was hanging around in the train station the entire time.
Well, yeah, but that was when the helicopter went quite low and seemed to pass fairly near the train station, so I thought it was him. I may be
so
wrong.
So you're basically fine as long as you don't go in this train station,
it
where
just,
they stay for the entire film.
It just seemed really an odd, plan.
But how many helicopter crashes are there in this film?
57.
There are at least three.
Yeah, three.
There are at least three. and none of the major, no major character ever gets injured in a helicopter crash.
Yeah, and that one at the beginning was pretty, it's like the line at the beginning of Fast Five, and no one was killed in that bus crash. Really? Because it rolled like 16 times and none of them was wearing a seatbelt.
It's the greatest film of all time, Helen.
Griggs dies in a helicopter crash. Griggs, of course, is Ike Barinholtz's character, who initially I thought, oh, when I saw, oh, he's having some banter with Deadshot, I thought, oh, this could be a really good scene-stealing man-on-train type person. And then I realised, no, it's Ike Barinholtz, and he's got an arc of sorts throughout the movie. But he dies in the helicopter crash, and the Joker's helicopter gets shot down, and he dies so quickly that I think a lot of people didn't realise that it was him.
There are a lot of deaths in this film, which I didn't spot some of them and other people didn't spot others. And I think a major problem that it has is they are trying to cram way too much in. You know, the Joker's henchmen looked amazing on set. They all had these incredible designs. There was a giant eyeball and a panda suit, and there was a tubby cosplay Batman dude that the Joker...
We see him,
You know, you see him very briefly, but there's so much. And the design, I think, is really good. The costumes are really good. But I feel like they try to cram everything into this film, and it means that you never really get to enjoy...
Yeah.
Not too much of it.
I do think that's a risk with all of these films. And it's, you know, it's something I worried about a lot in advance of Civil War, for example. It's like, are you trying to do too much? The old screenwriting maxim about keep it simple, stupid just seems to be one that not enough people pay attention to, especially in these big blockbuster films, because bigger does not always mean more characters. It does not always mean more plot. Sometimes it just means, you know, make more of what you have, I think.
Yep, I agree. But yeah, he does die. Griggs does die. The missile hits the helicopter, and you don't see him on the helicopter before that happens, but you see him turn around and go, oh shit, and then
I hope someone cleared his browser.
He gets killed. Which is a shame, because they were setting that character up, I think, to have some sort of beef with the Joker, or have the Joker kill him in some way. Perhaps it's good that they didn't go down the expected route, but also he was so much fun, I thought, in that role, as someone who just talked smack to the Suicide Squad, that it would have been nice to see him maybe given, I don't know, a more grandiose way out. Alright, well, that is it for our Suicide Squad spoiler special, All the S's. Don't forget to join us every Friday for the regular Mothership Empire podcast, if you don't already listen. And keep them peeled for future specials. We'll have a movie fill-ins special coming your way very, very soon. And our next spoiler special, I think, maybe, hopefully, that other lot's Doctor Strange. So you get a break for a couple of months before we come back with the spoiler stuff. Until that time, it is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Nick.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to get some ropes and start a climbing. Thanks for listening. See you there. Bye.